All right, so, yeah, if you haven't spent time here for a Friday night or for a theme weekend, we really value the time after lectures to really open up the conversation and explore the ideas or thoughts that you have in whatever direction you want to go. So nothing's off limits, except we're limited, but we'll do the best we can to kind of facilitate our discussion and clarify or expound whatever. So really, it's over to you. If there are thoughts or questions you want to pick up on, either from Joshua's sort of summary of Ben Sasse's book or from the lecture.
The first thing you said, the very first thing, the second thing was reflections on dominion from inside out. And then you said something else just before that.
But maybe she did.
Oh, maybe your title. Your entire
title. My title?
Yeah.
Question about the title of the lecture. The lecture. The lecture.
The second was reflections on dominion from the inside out.
Yep.
And the first one, I couldn't get that.
Yep. So I called this lecture self-love, self-help, self-control, reflections on dominion from the inside out.
Self-love, self-control.
Self-help, self-love, self-help, self-control. Just as part of my pre-writing for this lecture, I just brainstormed all the words that just came to mind, and it was a long list of self-this, self-that, self-self-self. I'm sure you would think of many as well. But, yeah, Marty.
I just have been struck by one parallel, how the Psalms might parallel some of the insights of cognitive behavioral therapy in the Psalms where you're talking to yourself, where you're reminding yourself of the truth. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder if you thought about that or commented, and, why are you cast down on my soul? Why are you disquieted within me? Remember, hope, and so that's an interesting, I think, helpful parallel, sort of the recognition that we're all schizophrenics, and then there's me, and then there's myself, and I have to talk to myself and remind myself of the truth. So I think part of it, that bring truth to bear, arguments and reason to bear on your emotions, is right there in the Psalms.
Yeah. Yeah, so thinking about the place of the Psalms in speaking back to ourselves, or even the way that it predates cognitive behavioral therapy, but it's teaching us how to put our feelings in dialogue with our thoughts, in dialogue with God. I think in many ways, this is sort of what prayer is. Like, for me, at least, not only this, but a big part of prayer is learning how to talk to myself in the presence of God and try to hear from God, often from the Psalms or any of the passages of Scripture that we read today, but letting these speak to me, letting prayer be a conversation. Do you have thoughts on that?
I'm a different person than Sarah, and I have. That's my only guess. I tend to. So, what I've learned from the Psalms about prayer, and at least one's emotional life, and emotional life before God, and what to do with emotions, I tend to think this. I tend to think God knows everything. So he must know how I feel, so I don't need to talk to him about that. I need to tell him what to do to fix it. But then you read the Psalms, like Psalm 22. You are 18 verses in of describing internal chaos that is in large part due to external chaos. And of feeling as though God, the experience of being forsaken by God. And all of this space describing the internal world. And so I think the assumption sometimes of the Psalms is like, God knows everything, therefore I'm going to be in dialogue or conversation with him about how I feel. And he knows, because he knows everything, I don't really need to tell him what to do right away. You know, there still are requests that come, and we still ask for things from God. So that's helped me bring my emotions to God, where I've tended to pray, like, okay, now do this and help this person, and blah, 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 move on. So.
Yeah, I listened to an interview between Eugene Peterson and Krista Tippett, the On Being interview, and one of the things that she asked him about the place of the Psalms in teaching us how to pray, and he said, you know, maybe we're comfortable being happy with God, probably less likely but possible that, you know, we can be sad with God. Very unlikely can we be angry with God. And he said, but the Psalms give us that full range. She was asking about the imprecatory Psalms, like, you know, praying for vengeance on enemies. And he drew a very direct line between our inability or our refusal to do that in prayer actually fueling conflict, war, like interpersonal and, you know, even larger scale violence. And that was an important thought to think about, how the Psalms restore to us a full range of human emotions and give us both permission by their very presence in Scripture and give us language to bring our emotions to God.
Yeah, John Calvin, who has a bad reputation, is probably thought of as someone with, like, cold and emotionless, and maybe that is due to some of his lineage or people that came after him. But he spoke about the Psalter as an anatomy of the human soul, and said everything you can possibly feel, the Psalms have felt, and they've expressed it towards God. And so you don't need to feel illegitimate because of what you're feeling. So it doesn't mean you need to stay where you are. The Psalms are a means to move through and move. So anyway, he's an older voice, but I think a helpful voice on reading the Psalms. Well, I've at least enjoyed them.
Lynn?
So, the calling of the American mind, and there was kind of a focus on, like, a school culture and Dewey and so forth. Now, not to get too critiquing of the American church, but I found myself asking the question, has the American church, particularly, I know a lot of us are in an evangelical tradition, how has our evangelical tradition coddled minds, particularly maybe minds of the children growing up in that tradition? That would be an interesting question for me.
Yes. So the question is kind of springing off from the Atlantic article on the coddling of the American mind in educational settings in the university, but asking how have we done that in our churches as well? I think that's a great question. Do you have thoughts?
I mentioned to you before, Mark Knoll wrote a book in like 1991, I think, something around that time. The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind, and the point was there wasn't much of an evangelical mind. There wasn't. The mind hadn't even been filled, let alone, like, coddled. He's written a subsequent book called Jesus Christ and the Life of the... Or it's on the shelf right behind Ben, but I forget what it's called. I can see it. It's got a weight on it. But it's basically saying the scene has changed significantly. The evangelicals, what is it called?
Jesus Christ and the Life of the Mind.
Jesus Christ and the Life of the Mind. Yeah, the scene has changed significantly, that there is a mind now in the evangelical church. At least people who identify as evangelicals are in all areas of research and inquiry. But I wonder if I would probably only have anecdotal reflections on how churches coddle the minds of young people, other than I don't know, maybe you're about to say something.
Well, I was just thinking that, I think the point in the Atlantic article is that to respond to the emotionalism of people in universities is making their feelings their whole being. Like, it's hijacking it's hijacking education, like that we can't have discordant conversation because it might make someone feel bad or worse than bad. And I guess I see in churches, I think we fall to extremes in the same way. Like we either, it's either sort of the like more of a stoicism in operation where like it's not actually a safe place to bring a full range of emotions into the congregational life, at least maybe with a small group after a very long time. But I think kind of the cultural pressure, at least in churches I've been in, is more toward, again, a narrowing of the range of human emotions that are acceptable in a congregational context. Maybe or maybe not a sort of vibrant intellectual engagement with faith. But, you know, in either case, it's a diminishment of the whole person by either an overemphasis or neglect, on one aspect of what it means to be human. So, Ben, do you have?
There was an article on Christianity Today a couple of years ago. I forget the whole title, but it had the word juvenalization in it.
Yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah.
Juvenalization of the church.
Youth culture.
It was talking about how sort of church youth culture of a previous generation, like the youth group model of what worship and what being church is, has basically become adult church in a subsequent generation, which is very emotion driven. Why would you follow Jesus unless he made us feel good, kind of? I think it's dangerous to talk in generalizations about evangelicalism, but certainly examples of that, I think, where it is, you know, you come to church for an experience, for an emotional experience, which is the indication that this is actually real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't have this. Mm-hmm. This sense of a high, and really, I think the article talked a lot about how that was an attempt to make church life appeal to a particular youth culture at the time by offering something similar to what they would get elsewhere. We can have just as many thrills following Jesus as listening to this music or whatever.
Which makes it very hard to share at least what a person thinks is a very authentic experience of the Holy Spirit, without feeling like, is this going to seem weird, or am I just playing into the drama of it all?
It's only a few emotions. There's like there's five emotions you can feel in this worship service, and they're all on like a happy clappy. I think of this guy Christian Smith, who is a sociologist at Notre Dame, he talks about how the faith of young people young people in the church is, he calls it, moralistic therapeutic deism.
Yeah.
So moralistic, God just wants people to be good. Therapeutic, it's to make me happy. And then deism, it's just like God's sort of, I don't know, he's there, he's God. There's not much doctrinal.
Yeah.
There's not much, liveliness. So, his book, what is it called, Soul Searching? It's Lost in Transition or something?
He's got a couple of books.
They're so sad. Were you, Lydia, you?
Well, I, having done youth ministry for a long time and then school, when I think of coddling the mind, it's this idea of what Ben was starting to say, it's this entertainment model for youth ministry, rather than taking their mind seriously and really giving them things. I just have found that the best way to actually make young people feel some ownership of their lives and other things is to take them really seriously and to present them with things that are just a little bit above where they are and let them reach and ask questions and then really compliment the questions that they ask and have serious discussion. Even the material that's sometimes written for Sunday school or things where you ask, how do you feel about this?
Mm.
That's not the right question yet. First, mm-hmm. you've got to see what is being
what,
said.
What do you see?
What's happening? They're not equipped to feel something about it. It doesn't mm-hmm. really matter what they feel about mm-hmm. it. Mm-hmm. You've got to give them some content mm-hmm. in an appropriate way. And they like that. If mm-hmm. you take their minds seriously, mm-hmm.
yeah.
it, I see
yeah, you respect
it
them.
Rise to yeah. that kind of treatment.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
rather than thinking you've got to entertain them mm-hmm. and that'll keep them in the church somehow.
Because
mm-hmm.
right? the church is always a little behind, and it's like yeah. it's always better outside of church, like mm-hmm. cool, fun things. Mm-hmm. Like if that's what the church is sort of competing with,
yeah.
you're always
never gonna
yeah.
do it.
But if you offer something different, you know, like
sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you have something you want to say?
This is just a comment. So mm-hmm. reacting to that, some of the things that were said. Mm-hmm. There's a couple books by T. David Gordon, Why Johnny Can't Preach and Why Johnny Can't Sing Hymns. And they're sort of talking about how embrace the youth culture and dumb down preaching, like these big words, dumb down what we sing to make it more accessible for people who don't haven't gone in depth.
Yeah. It was T. David Gordon, you said, recommendations. Yeah.
I think we talked a little bit, Sarah, earlier, mm-hmm. but a couple of observations that I guess I would have is that we seem to have avoided the, and I saw even Tim Keller has a book in there, and I've read it three times, so C.S. Lewis is The Problem of Pain.
Mm-hmm.
We've avoided that in our, you didn't obviously in your lecture,
mm-hmm.
we've avoided with our children the notion of pain and suffering is a part of life. And I don't
mm-hmm.
mean terrible pain and suffering. It's
mm-hmm.
a part of life. And so if they're grounded in God and values and family and then the ecosystem of church, community,
mm-hmm.
and we teach them to understand what they need
mm-hmm.
and to set boundaries, meaningful boundaries, it will allow them to have a much more realistic approach in society and how to kind of work between this veil of ecosystems that they have to survive in.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we have set up some unrealistic expectations with our youth.
Mm-hmm.
And as you just mentioned, we haven't really taught them how to think.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't all about feeling. There has
mm-hmm.
to be logic and
mm-hmm.
kind of
mm-hmm.
thinking things through, problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
It's interesting. Just in the Ben Sasse book, where he talks about discovering your body, this idea of intergenerational relationships, he talks about his wife before they were married would regularly visit elderly care facilities or old folks homes, in large part to learn, like to see, like
mm-hmm.
and to realize this is. He talks a lot in that chapter about. Like, we have to realize we're going to die and we're going to suffer. And if we just keep pushing that out of out of what we see, it doesn't actually make it go away. It's when it comes then, it's so much worse.
Yeah.
We have no models of suffering well. And as a culture, we have so few models of aging well. Because once someone gets old, like, or older, they're sort of put out to pasture, and we bring in somebody new who we're going to be all excited about. And one of the things that's interesting that sort of piggybacks with him is there's a woman who teaches at Fuller Theological Seminary named Kara Powell, and she talks about sticky faith. How do we have young people who grow up in the church? How does their faith stick? What are the things we do? And she looks at all of these sorts of factors. That you were talking about, like being hip, being cool, having head mics, and like all sorts of fun music. But she said the primary thing, the main thing, is intergenerational relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Your kids are friends to some extent. Obviously, there's difference, but are friends with your friends. That people like that your young kids know kids that are teenagers, and your teenagers definitely know non-teenagers as well, and have some sort of substantial relationship with them. And this is, I think this is such a vital thing that the church could could offer. And we, I mean, my church doesn't do a great job of this, even though we've talked about this. But mm-hmm. like, how do we make space for these sorts of things?
I'm part of a study, a scripture group, a couple of them. This is one I attended last night. Mm-hmm. And it's comprised of maybe 6 or 7 families that actually knew each other before they had their kids, and have been studying scripture for 25 years.
Wow.
So some of them go to different churches. What blows my mind is what you just described, because when you're with them as family, all the kids, you know, we went camping this summer, right? It's the first time I ever joined them. And it's intergenerational. And these kids can talk to adults, and they relate with one another, and they're Christian-based, and I just, it's wonderful to see.
Yeah.
And they rely on that. They've created this sort of ecosystem that branches out, of course, to church and community. It's really fabulous.
Yeah, briefly, one of the most amazing things I've seen happen in this room was a New Year's Eve party, and the family that used to live here, Joan, Sue, Morell, with their boys Luke and Nate, would have their friends over, and we were only here for a few of them, but their teenage sons and daughters, who could be doing who knows what on New Year's Eve. And some of them were really popular, like really cool kids, and were probably expected to be at these other parties. But they were here dancing to Carly Rae Jepsen and to Beyonce with their parents, like just hanging out with their parents and their parents' friends. And it was, we were like, what happened? Like, how did they do this? And, you know, they're not. No one's a perfect parent, but like that to me is like was an amazing thing to watch, and something that I hope for our kids too. But yeah, anyway.
Yeah, just along the same lines that we used to go to a church where the youth group, it would advertise, you know. This Saturday we're going for movies, pizza, and a Christmas shop till you drop. Again, just basically, kids can handle social life and consumerism. The teen Bible, which has stories about acne and things, but rather, why do teenagers need a different Bible from the adult Bible? And I've talked to a lot of young people just feel condescended to that way. But this is a huge passion for me, is why in the church, there is age segregation everywhere in the world. There doesn't have to be in the church.
Yeah.
So, and there's nothing sanctified about it in the Bible. In fact, I did a word study of all the different age groups, from infant to young child to the adolescent, who is the one who shakes free, all the way up the mature one, the old. And there's all these imperatives throughout the Bible that just assume a lot of natural non-professional interaction between all the ages. And it just, you know, it's wonderful to hear stories like yours, but that should be happening in churches. We don't, you know, don't necessarily fire the youth pastor, but maybe you do. Or you rethink it. You rethink it, and a youth pastor could do a lot more to integrate the ages so that there is this intergenerational friendship and the modeling that goes both ways. Because like Paul says, with respect to imitate babies, infants, with respect to evil. Mm-hmm. And that's what you think, you know, what can a baby teach me about evil? Yeah. Well, babies are innocent of premeditated evil. Mm-hmm. This doesn't mean they're not fallen, but they don't premeditate evil. So if I don't know any babies, or Jesus says you can't even get into the kingdom of heaven unless you become like a child. Yeah. What does that mean if I don't know any children? And so it goes. And the youth are described as their strength. The strength is in the youth. So the older people need the strength of the young. The younger people need the more experience of the older. But why we don't in churches to do more to break down the age segregation, I don't understand.
Yeah.
Liz?
Yeah, it's. I feel like a lot of things are encapsulated in this example of Canada had, like, I guess, maybe 2 years ago now, legalized physician-assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. It's been really interesting to sort of see that and talking to one of our colleagues at Dutch Liberty, where it's much farther along, because there it's legal for minors, for people who are not just depressed, but just having existential issues, and so that's kind of like, that seems like the extreme end point of this, like making your feelings like the primary reality, and if you're suffering, or in any way, whether it's mental or physical, that your life no longer has value or meaning, and you have nothing to offer, and it's better, we're better off without those people as well, like for their sake and for ours, and it just seems like a huge problem to shut ourselves off from anything like that. And that seems like an abdication of agency. Yeah. Like people are lauding it as like this high moral choice to decide to do that and to not put your family through suffering or whatever. But actually, it seems like abdication to me.
There's a little document, like a 6-minute video documentary on the BBC. The BBC did about this, about a 17-year-old girl in the Netherlands who like planned the day she was going to die. And so they walk you through her last few days. And she's doing all of her favorite things one last time, including having a meal with her friends. And then you see her walk into the clinic, and like that's sort of the end of the thing. And it's quite, it's confusing to say the least. You feel all sorts of things at the same time as you're watching it. But
which looks like Dominion, right? But it's not. It's like
Yeah, and it's pretty, like you said, it has this sort of moral, this high morality to it.
Yeah.
Are you going to say something, Ben?
No.
Yes, Claire.
I have a question. Changing the topic just a little bit, more from the book review, but either one of you can answer based on your research. I'm wondering if you found anything based on gender for the lack of embracing adulthood. Just the different circles I've moved in, moved around in, I'm seeing more and more women embracing adulthood and less men. I'm also a millennial, so I feel like I'm always like, I don't know, observing my peers and seeing what the heck everyone's doing.
contributing to that, there's all sorts of factors. I mean, I think the video game statistics are primarily male.
Pause. I just want to repeat the question.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Good job doing your job. You are exercising dominion. The question was if we've come across anything in regard to gender with a struggle or a failure to exercise dominion. And what's your name?
I'm Hannah.
Hannah. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. And Hannah was just saying, in her observation, women seem to step into adulthood more so than the men she's seen in her life. Sorry. Thank you.
No, it's okay. So I don't necessarily, I can like really give all the reasons why that I think. I do think it's interesting. So there's this guy, Jordan Peterson, who has become this voice piece for growing up, especially for men. And he says, the reason I'm successful is because the reason why this has caught on is because I went on YouTube. And statistically, YouTube is guys. There's more men on YouTube than any other social media platform. And that is one reason why he chose YouTube and one reason why he credits some of his taking off, because there's these wandering, directionless young men who are scrolling through whatever on YouTube, and then they find this guy who's challenging them to make their bed and to like do something with their life. And then there's other studies too about like other forms of social media that are more like statistically or stereotypically more female. So things like Instagram and connecting those to higher rates of anxiety and depression and even suicide, because those get wrapped up. I mean, those are about looking better than someone else. It's all about appearances, and then it's this terrible, terrible cycle where you feel worse about yourself. And anyway, but in regards to like other sort of social factors, I'd be really curious if other, or further up, or down, back upstream, further upstream, things that contribute to men not becoming adults. I'd be curious to hear other people's.
There's, apparently, according to Ben and Dick and Book of Genesis, passing the buck from the beginning.
I mean, I could throw out a couple guesses. I do think men sometimes lack models of engaged adult males. So that an adult male is usually not emotional, and is kind of harder to sort of have serious conversations about because they like their job, they like being out and doing things, they like sports. And I mean, my experience, not just with my own young son, but with other young boys, is they are hungry for those sorts of engagement, that sort of thing that they're not actually getting from their stereotypical father. Which then, yeah, sort of creates internal dynamics or patterns that don't make them want to risk in case of failing. But I don't think that's just a male thing. Anybody else want to throw something out? I'll throw it out again. Yep.
This is going to be not the good, maybe, but one of the... So I was thinking, so as a millennial male, the sort of the model for like what it means to be a responsible male adult for me was like you get a job and you work that job till you retire. Mm-hmm. And not that that's a bad thing, but mm-hmm. that becomes an abdication of like emotional contact and, you know, raising children in a way that is, you know, that prioritizes the good things. That in a way is an abdication of things. And so I think, I don't know, this might play into it a bit, but like I feel like I don't want that. Like I want better things than just a job and a 401k and whatever. Not that that's a bad thing. So there's this tension there of like, well, what does it mean to be a responsible adult, a responsible male adult? I don't know. Just some initial thoughts.
No. Yeah.
What am I reacting to in not being employed at 30 or whatever? You know, am I trying to value other things, or am I really searching for something else or what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. As you were saying, made me think. I think, this, speaking from my own experience, but I've come across this sort of in research as well, that women generally just do a better job of connecting and empowering other women. And not that we can't be competitive, but I wonder if, that's one of the reasons. More women have more women saying yes,
yes,
yes, and then men do. Carla?
I think part of it is also women, the movement of realizing I can't rely on a man to take care of me. Mm-hmm. Things happen, I don't know, you know, whether it has already happened or it might, but wanting to be self-sufficient and all those markers of adulthood, I know there's still plenty of women who are not there either, but as far as getting a job and moving out and taking care of themselves in that way, mm-hmm. I think that has become more important mm-hmm. for young women.
Mm-hmm. Allison?
Just to sort of tag off of that, I'm wondering if the previous model of the man who gets the job for 40 years and has a good 401k, but in that picture is often wife and children, the job is for the purpose of supporting others, mm-hmm. even if it can also be an abdication of like, well, I put food on the table, so that's all I really need to do. Mm-hmm. And then mm-hmm. I just put my feet up and you guys mm-hmm. sort it out amongst yourselves. Mm-hmm. But if some of like the way in which that is also changing, because if men feel unneeded, then what's the point of getting that job and the 401k mm-hmm. if you don't have, mm-hmm. if there's not someone for whom, yeah. I don't know, I guess I'm just kind of wondering out loud.
Yeah.
If they
don't feel needed, but maybe there's also a fear of being needed.
Right, right. But I do also feel like this, I also aspire to be someone who is able to put food on my own table, knowing that it all comes from God, but trust in the Lord, and that tension of, well, I do think sometimes that I want to be married and have children, and other times as a teacher I'm like, okay, maybe be on that side of things and be a really great aunt. And then, I don't know, but God knows, right? So like, yeah, got that sorted, hopefully, maybe whenever. I'm working on trusting. But it's like dynamic between us created in God's image and our gendered selves that is like, I want independence. I don't want men to feel like I don't need them, but I kind of don't want to need them, which is a really nice thing to say out loud.
Especially them in that way.
Yes. Or maybe need them for something that they're not being trained or equipped to provide.
Many of the people here could be my kids. I'm a boomer. And if you've ever watched, a while back, PBS had the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. There is no easy answer because we came along in the late 60s and early 70s and we as women blew it up. We blew it up. We didn't need men. We were going to make it on our own. And so you have this sort of churning thing in society for the past 30 or 40 years since we raised our kids. We want our girls to be able to earn a living and take care of themselves. We want our boys to be self-fulfilled and be good men, whatever that means. But you said something at the end of your presentation, Sarah, that's so important. It's about being a team. It's about, we're in a period of realignment. And so it's some of the most effective young families you see today are ones where they're a team. Or maybe some men really love being at home and the woman thinks, but they're comfortable in this new skin, or they're equally partnered. Or it may very well be, I can think of one family where the woman is a chemist by training. She has stayed home for 15 years because they decided that her being home raising the kids was equally as important as him going out and earning a living. So how do we, you know, raise our young folks, and you're really not that young now, right? You're 30, getting ready to go towards 40, to get people to understand it's about being a team. It can't all be about being self-fulfilled.
This is very complex, and I don't pretend, I think they're multifaceted, but one facet I think is very real, is the sexual revolution. Because men used to have to get married to have sex. Now, it's very easy for men to have lots of sex without the commitment of marriage and supporting a family. And most women, so you have the new relationship system. You know, you live with someone for a while, and then it's very often when the woman wants to have a child, she wants to be married to the man that she's that's the father of the child. She talks about marriage, and the guy bolts. But you know, the sort of phrase, if you can get all these bennies of marriage, if you can have sex and security, somebody helping, you know, looking after you and living with them, without marriage, lots of men have said, it's a marriage project starting out of Rutgers, I think, or York University, they would much rather, you know, just live with somebody and enjoy the benefits. So that's one big thing, that is just men not marrying, that's just one of the markers. But I also think about the difference, and this is again huge, but when this country was mostly farmers, and now it's only 1% of people are on farms, boys worked alongside their dad. The adults' work was something they contributed to the real work of the family. They were working alongside their dads. The daughters were working alongside their mothers, but they all knew that what they were doing was important now, essential now to the economy of the family, and was going to continue to be. And that's something we really need to think about, how we can. A lot of kids don't even know what their parents do. We had a student here once at breakfast at our house when we were up there. He was just here for a week, and I said, "Oh, well, where are you from, and what do your folks do?" And he could tell me what his mother did, but a cloud went over his face, and he said, "Ah, my dad is some kind of a consultant." He was 20. They didn't even know it as well. So the disconnect between work. Anyway, I mean, this is just pieces.
And also I think, too, with that, there's been a implicit, maybe in some places it's explicit, narrative that, like, your life needs to be better than your parents' life. Like, you need to have made more money. Like, that's just the way history is going. We need, you know, like, we need to have bigger couches than our parents' couches. And I think we sort of hit a tipping point.
Yeah.
And, like, life hasn't been better. It's probably not going to get much better. So that... I think that comes in on a gut level for some people, and they realize, I don't want to do whatever my parents did, or I can't compete with that, and there's, it spirals. And anyone else have anything?
So I think we have time for one more, or if this is on the same topic, if you want to say, and then we could have maybe one more question. Yeah.
I was thinking kind of along the same lines. I was trying to formulate it nice and succinctly, but I can't. So, but just the idea of that my parents' generation, we didn't see our parents. They worked. So there was no training. So I feel like when I look at my brother and his response to that, it's, well, I don't know what it looks like to be a man, because I just saw my dad get up and leave and come home and go to bed. And he's just working. And it's like, who wants that? And who wants to raise children in that sort of environment? So I feel like that plays a lot into the men, they're of age men, but they're boys. Just what, well, I wasn't trained because my father wasn't around, and I really want to enjoy my life. I don't want to live for work. You know, we have a whole generation that's working for the weekend and just don't, because there's no training. Like the industrial revolution, the switch, and then the sexual revolution, so then the no longer a need for marriage. So it's, if I don't have to support anybody, if I don't have to be responsible, then why would I? And even if I could, I don't know how.
This actually reminds me of Reverend Lloyd's question last night, and kind of like, what if we just don't even have an imagination for what it would look like to grow up into, to come home, or to be whole, or to grow up into adulthood? We feel so disconnected, and in fact are, from that whole process, and then we lack a resonance with the result of that. Like, I don't know if I want that. Is there one more topic or question you want to raise?
Yes. If it's okay, if we switch the subject.
Yeah.
I love your description of self-control as remaining in the fight between the spirit and the flesh. Oh. And I'm not a fighter. So I wonder if you have any encouragement or, I don't know, more thoughts about, like, remaining in the fight.
Repeat the question.
Thank you. The question was appreciating the idea that self-control is remaining in the fight between the spirit and the flesh, knowing that you are securely on the side of the spirit, but saying, I'm not a fighter, so what does that really mean? Or like, what does that look like? I think you're going to need to answer that for yourself, ultimately. We all need to answer, like, what does it look like for me to stay in the fight? And, just sort of on a simple level, like, I think it's, for me, at least, it's noticing when I start to go into, like, that adrenaline fight or flight mode. And for me, it looks like flight, like, not staying in the fight, like, I give up. I'm not going to lecture. I'm running away. Like, I sort of go there in my imagination.
Shaking your head. Yeah.
Someone else can step in and they'll do a better job. They don't really need me. And, like, it's a temptation. This is why I think the law of self-control, like, the temptation, like, here comes the attack. The temptation is to, like, flee the city, get out of here altogether, So for me, it begins with an awareness of, like, when that's happening, and then I think, you have to know. This is another thing that Tim Keller said, quoting, I think, John Owen, a Puritan pastor?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's only two pastoral jobs. One, the first one is convincing those who are in the dominion of sin that they are in the dominion of sin, and the second is convincing those who are under the dominion of sin that they are not under the dominion of sin. And I thought, that's really profound. For me, staying in the fight means saying, I am not under the dominion of sin. The flesh loses in the long run. Like, I am in Christ, and the flesh loses. And I'm just going to be like a Tim Keller groupie right now. But he says, like, when you are in Christ, the flesh has been dealt a mortal wound. And it's like an injured mother bear. Like, it's angry. And, you know, like, you don't want to come across a mother bear, but you really don't want to come across an injured mother bear. And, you know, so sort of knowing your enemy, like, I'm dealing with an injured mother bear here. Like, my flesh has been dealt a mortal wound. Like, the flesh will die, is dying, in fact. And so for me, it's that last part of, like, I am securely on the side of the Spirit here. Even when it feels very intense, that kind of talking back to myself is an important piece. You're not alone, and you cannot be alone. I know that I live in a unique setup here, but for me, sometimes like literally stepping out my door can change things. And so I think you all need to sort of answer that, what that looks like in your own life, but to engage, just to step outside of the sense of the fight, and to be like, and there are other people, and there's more in this picture. That helps me sort of put myself in scale. Thank you. We could talk more over lunch, or if others have thoughts on that, you can continue that conversation.
Yes, so lunch is ready. Thank you both for facilitating the discussion. Michaela has made these